You want to make a real impact in the Black community? Join us where we connect you with Black-led organizations from all around the world. Get ready to get involved. Find the organization based on the location of interest. Follow us at supportblackcharities.org.
Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. Recent preliminary findings from a Lower Mainland-based research project shows that road salt used to defrost icy roads in the winter months may be having negative impacts on local salmon populations. The Road Salt and Pacific Salmon Success Project is a research project that is investigating these potential negative effects. In collaboration with 13 stream stewardship groups, the University of British Columbia, Simon Fraser University, the British Columbia Institute of Technology, and Fisheries and Oceans Canada, this project was originally spearheaded by the Stony Creek Environment Committee in Burnaby, BC. CJSF was able to get in contact with John Templeton, president of the Stony Creek Environment Committee, a volunteer organization dedicated to preserving and enhancing Burnaby's urban forest and salmon-bearing stream through various stream-keeping activities. We met with Templeton at Tributary 3A of Stony Creek, where he told us his journey with Stony Creek began.
I've always had a total love for nature. It was my playground in the countryside. There weren't any shopping malls, there weren't any rec centers, so nature became something that became part of me. So when I got to the point in my life where I could give back, I started volunteering at Stony Creek for 21 years.
During our time with Templeton, he took us for our own journey through Stony Creek, where he explained what originally spurred the Road Salt and Salmon Research Project.
So how this salt project got going was, many years ago, one of our volunteers, Vladimir, he was a biologist from the Soviet Union, we had checked the water quality, saw that there was an unusually high concentration of salt. So that spooked Vladimir's interest. Was it harmful to the salmon eggs that were spawned in the fall? So we got a project going where they took salmon eggs and they put them into Tributary 3A, which flows into Stony Creek. We also put them into another creek where the water quality was very good. What we discovered through that project were three things. That in Tributary 3A, there was a higher mortality. More of the fertilized eggs died. So those eggs didn't develop. Of the fish that did develop, we noticed that there was a hemorrhaging on some of the eggs in the kidney area. And the other thing we noticed, that there were deformities. Some of the preliminary results have shown that when the eggs are first deposited, if there's a pulse of salt comes down, and that salt concentration is high, it will kill the eggs. They've also discovered that there will be mortalities and the eggs won't survive if there's continued salt pulses in high concentration. So we know that it's a harmful effect.
Afterwards, Templeton talked about the unique situation of Stony Creek due to its close proximity to Burnaby Mountain.
We know that this creek is continually contaminated because many years ago when SFU was built, they had a salt shed. And that salt shed was built, and unfortunately, like 60 years ago when SFU was built, they didn't think much about the salt permeating into the ground and contaminating the soil. So what we discovered when we would do our water samples, that there's a high concentration. Now, normally you would expect that concentration to disappear once winter and salt use on roads is over. But what we actually noticed, as the water flow decreased when it was drier in the summer, the time you're hitting August and September, the concentrations are getting higher and higher. And that was because the ground was contaminated. So that's another long story and another long battle with SFU. But eventually we got them to relocate their old salt shed. But the ground there is still very contaminated. So we actually call Tributary 3A, we call it Salt Creek because of those concentrations that are continually coming down.
Despite the various issues that stem from road salt usage, the research project has also highlighted various alternatives that have shown to be less harmful for local salmon populations, from alternative defrosting solutions to just simply using less salt.
Yes, and in fact, what SFU did, they pioneered using beet juice, which is a sort of like a sugar kind of a beet that they come from Tabor in Alberta. And they would mix that with salt water, and that brine solution, when it's sprayed onto the road surface, what happens, it will enable the salt and brine to last longer than just pure salt put on the road surface. So it protects the road longer and causes the ice to melt, so that's a win.
While the Road Salt and Pacific Salmon Success Project is ongoing, John Temple and the Stony Creek Environment Committee will continue to care for and analyze their local streams, as well as the salmon populations that inhabit them. Once again, thank you so much for listening to this piece. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. This segment would not be possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
My name is Eric Swanson, and I'm a dad of two young girls. It was a game changer when we learned that $10 a day childcare was being offered to both our kids. And we want all BC families to have this option. To get there, BC has to do three key things. Pay fair and consistent wages for all childcare educators. Transition all existing programs to $10 a day. And plan childcare expansion more like we do schools and hospitals. BC's on the right track, but we need to go faster. Go to 10aday.ca to learn more.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Reporting from Burnaby, British Columbia, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. Sanders Whiting is a specialist in voice and presentation skills affiliated with the Center for Educational Excellence at Simon Fraser University. Sanders has been instrumental in supporting faculty, staff, and teaching assistants at SFU since 2014. Leveraging his diverse background as a professional actor, Sanders brings considerable knowledge and expertise to his practice. Over the next few months, Sanders Whiting will be hosting a series of workshops on voice and presentation skills at Simon Fraser University. CJSF was able to sit down with Sanders Whiting and speak on his development process for these workshops, as well as what he hopes SFU faculty and staff are able to take away from his teachings. Please take a listen. Today in studio, I am joined with Sanders Whiting. Thank you so much for being here today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, the first thing I want to ask is if you could just give a brief overview of the sort of voice and speech instructing that you do here at SFU.
Sure. The category for what I do is called voice and presentation skills. They go together, of course, really well. And so what I focus on is how people use their voice to make this just the sound of their voice effective, and then also how they use text. That's usually what we mean by speech, is how are they using text. And there's a lot of things that fall into that category, two of them being enunciation or diction, and the other one being emphasis. And so those are two things that strongly affect text, for example. And the other things are how you are in your body, how comfortable a person is with gesture, whether they feel shaky or whether they feel grounded. So finding ways to ground people is really, it really nurtures their confidence. And so feelings of confidence is a huge thing. A lot of people feel nervous, and so I tend to help people reframe that in a way that makes them feel more empowered.
That empowerment aspect, that seems to be a big part of the work you do. How did you get involved in the first place?
My background is in theater, music, and education. So I'm a professional actor. I have been teaching for about 11, 12 years teaching, started teaching singing, and then got pulled into the voice and speech world. Somebody who I knew that held my current position at SFU, which is with the Center for Educational Excellence, she said, "I think you'd be the right person to take over my job." And I came in to SFU and started teaching people about voice and presentation skills. I've been doing that since 2014. And the training in theater, of course, naturally lends itself really well to teaching voice and presentation skills. I teach a lot of the things. I teach some very complicated, intense diction exercises that you learn if you would, say, work at a place like the Royal Shakespeare Company in England. I use top quality content in my workshops.
What would you say is the most rewarding thing when it comes to the work you do and the people that you help with vocal training?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I hate to use an overused word, empowering people. Mm-hmm. When you see somebody that came in and they're nervous, and they know they always get nervous, and their voice gets shaky, and they discover how to overcome that, and they are often surprised that it's a lot easier than they think. Not that it doesn't take practice, but anytime you get to a job where when people leave the session, you can tell that they've got a new tool that they can confidently take forward. It's pretty pleasurable as a teacher.
Would you say when it comes to people developing their presentation skills and their vocal skills, are there any sort of pitfalls or misconceptions that you think people have regarding how they can improve those things?
Yeah, there's probably a few. One of the pitfalls is thinking that you're born with a particular type of voice and it's stuck that way. our voices can do a huge variety of things. The voice we use is generally the voice that we're just habituated to, that we use, that we feel it's okay, it works. But people can do such a huge array of things with their voices. It doesn't matter what age they're at, they can always improve it, make it more powerful, get greater range. Another thing is that you need to put on a show, that people think, oh, I have to present, I have to put on a show. And an interesting thing that's come along, I think, with so many things on our world, with everything's on video and YouTube and things like this, is we've got a really strong sense, sort of a sensory thing about people being full of baloney, right? And so one great mentor that I got to work with, and all the courses I took with him were online. He's an American singing teacher and presentation skills teacher. And his videos originally were very slick, beautifully lit. And then I noticed one day he switched and there was just a brick wall in the background. I think he was just using his phone. And this was about 10 years ago. And I was surprised at my feeling that I kind of trusted him more, because he took away the special lighting and all that stuff. Nothing wrong with that stuff. It's an art in itself. But realizing that people are enough, and that's a little phrase we use for actors a lot of the time. Actors are trying to be bigger than they are, to fill the shoes of Hamlet or somebody really famous. But actually, it's learning to ground yourself in a sense of just being who you are in your body. I am enough. It gives you a sense of authenticity. And you may have noticed that things have gone from being really splashy and hard sell, like 10 years ago, to now people are really trying to appeal to you that I'm telling you the truth, that it's not fake news, right? And so just people relaxing and being themselves. And one of the things that they can counter this feeling of having to put on a performance is that you're really there to serve the people that you're talking to. Mm-hmm. And that changes your status. When you change your status to somebody that I'm here to help, I may not be perfect, but I'm here to help these people, it can change your feeling of how being in the room is. And so that, along with accepting who you are and then go, I'm here to help, I'll do whatever I can to help, that is usually a huge paradigm shift in people's heads, that going, oh, I could make a mistake up here, but I'm here to help people, so I'll keep going forward in a bolder way.
The way you described it there, it's so much more than just developing a skill to be utilized in a career or academic setting. There's a degree of learning to accept yourself.
Well, and that's what I think a lot of people want. If you're going to buy a car from somebody, you're hoping the person's authentic and real. And I think that's almost a kind of a new aesthetic that we have. If you hear somebody on a talk show, you want to hear who they are. You want to hear the real person. You'll see a lot more people exposing how vulnerable they are as people on talk shows and things. And it's kind of a new thing of people in some ways being allowed to be more human. And I think that's something that we really gravitate towards. And another way to call it is bringing the whole person into the room. Mm-hmm. I'm not just bringing a performer into the room. I'm bringing me with all my foibles. And it's interesting. It's even a technique some people use. They make a mistake early on purpose, so people can go, oh, you make mistakes too? Oh, I like you. I can identify with you. So I don't purposefully do that, but I don't try to make mistakes. But if I make one, people can see that, oh, you're a human being too, and it makes one much more relatable.
Mm-hmm. One thing I wanted to ask you is, because the workshops you're doing here at Simon Fraser University are sort of a series of ongoing workshops, and all of them sort of tackle different aspects of presentation and vocal skills. How did you develop that, and how did you choose, which specific aspects of presentation giving to sort of focus in on for each person or for each workshop in this case?
Well, I love that question because when I first came to it, I was coming from the theater world and I've worked a lot and I've started getting back into it as an actor on big stages with lots of people, sometimes with very often without a mic. Many stages don't have mics. And so I'm coming into the room and with this feeling in my body, it should feel like this, it should be this presentation, big thing, and realizing over time, that's not quite what people need. And what I would find through doing many workshops since 2014, I do from two to eight workshops a month, and then I do private sessions. And this is all for faculty or graduate students who teach or instructional staff that teach, right? It's got to be somebody. People can work with me as long as I'm doing something with them that has to do with teaching. And I lost my chain of thought there. Where was I? And so how did I develop these things? So it's people coming into the room and going, so what would you like to explore today? And people, if they've made an appointment, especially for a private appointment, they know exactly what they want to do. They'll go, oh, my voice, I stand up and it starts to get shaky. It never does that with my family, or things like that. And I say, oh, well, let's address stability in the voice. Most of what people come to me for are either voice problems. They feel that they don't know how to project. And projection's actually quite simple. You can teach people to do it fairly quickly. It's more a psychological shift. And then the other things are nervousness in their body, shaking, shaky voice, shaky hands, and really teaching them to ground themselves in their body. And then just feelings of nervousness, which they'd like to transform into feelings of confidence. So those are largely the things, vocal things, then how do you live in your body? How do you relax in your body? And how do you feel more confident? Those are the three major things that, and I give surveys after courses too, after workshops, and say, was that beneficial to you? The feedback is so useful, and say, what else might you like to explore? What else would you like to see? So that's how I determine what gets offered in a workshop.
The major last thing I want to ask you is if you can tell me what you hope the people that attend these workshops and that attend your instructional sessions, what do you hope their main takeaway is, you know, after just one of these workshops or sessions?
To be generous. That's the biggest thing. That's the biggest paradigm shift in one's head. It's not to outperform somebody. It's not to bamboozle somebody. It's to really be there to serve people. It will take away your nervousness and look at everything in presentation skills. Is generosity. Volume is generosity, making it so people can easily hear you. They don't have to lean in and try to read your lips because they can't hear things well enough. So anything like that, volume, even pretending you're a little bit confident, instills confidence in your audience. So you can even fake that out of it as a form of generosity. I'm going to behave generously, so you'll buy into the things that I'm talking about. So I would say generosity and a bit of boldness.
All right. I believe that is all the time we have for this interview, but I want to thank you so much for coming in and speaking with me on these presentations that you have going on at the moment. Would you like to say any sort of last words on this workshop series or just the work you do at SFU for any faculty or students that may be listening?
Well, I'd like to encourage people that their voice is it represents them in a huge way. It's kind of like their signature. When you walk into a room, and to be generous with your voice, to be generous with the energy that you have, that reads really well. And for people in university transitioning into careers and things like that, going into a room with a generous boldness, people will like that. Not everybody will, but I would assume most people go, I can work with that, I'll hire that. And if you're faculty and you go into a room with a generous, sort of happy boldness, students feel that. They feel attended to. They feel taken care of and that you're concerned about them. So, yeah, taking in this sort of concern for other people, I'd say that's the biggest message.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Danny.
Once again, you were listening to our conversation with Sanders Whiting, teaching enhancement specialist at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia. This piece would not be possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
Quelle est l'importance de cette station pour vous? Une station locale, des nouvelles et des informations qui comptent. Vous ne trouverez rien de tel ailleurs. Maintenant, nous avons besoin de vous, de votre voix, pour soutenir l'initiative des radios communautaires. La radio a été là pour vous dans des moments importants, et maintenant, c'est à votre tour. Vous pouvez vous joindre à la lutte pour l'avenir de la radio communautaire sur monirc.ca. Encore monirc.ca, des voix locales qui façonnent notre communauté.
Hi, this is Sukyun Lee. And you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby.
Hello, my name is Hilary Letwin. I'm the manager of cultural services for the city of Coquitlam.
Thanks for joining me. And today we're here to talk about the Riverview Hospital Artifact Collection and a new database that makes that collection accessible and browsable online. To start with, what is the Riverview Hospital Artifact Collection?
That's a great question. So I'll just step back for a minute and speak a little bit about my larger portfolio within the city organization. So I joined the city team in September of 2024, and part of my portfolio includes the care for our public art collection, as well as our relationship with our service providers with whom we have partnerships, our cultural partners. So that includes the Evergreen Cultural Center, the Coquitlam Public Library, Coquitlam Heritage, and Place des Arts. And the Riverview Artifacts Collection is an additional part of my portfolio as the manager of cultural services for the city. So I have learned a lot about the Riverview Artifacts Collection since I started working for the city back in September. And just to speak a little bit to the history of the collection, it actually came into city ownership in 2012. It was transferred to us from the Provincial Health Authority, and it consists of about 2,500 historical artifacts. They reflect the history of the Riverview Hospital, which is located in Coquitlam, hence the geographical proximity to the city. The collection was actually amassed and cared for by a nonprofit society for a number of years. That's the Riverview Hospital Historical Society. It was a group of very dedicated volunteers who had some sort of professional or personal connection to the hospital. And when it became clear in the 1990s that the Provincial Health Authority was probably going to be closing Riverview Hospital, this group of volunteers got together and started to create what they saw as a representative collection of artifacts from its time as a hospital. And it was opened in 1913, so that's almost a century of medical history, essentially.
What is it about the Riverview Hospital and this collection of artifacts that makes it worthy of preservation or interesting to preserve as a collection?
In the minds of our team, it's really all about offering a snapshot into the history of mental health in Western Canada. And the artifacts themselves range from furnishing